The following is a 2.5-hour recording of the February 28, 2012 work session on LD 1798, an act to reform land use planning in the unorganized territory. The work session was being held by Maine Legislature's Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry Committee. The recording begins about 10 minutes into the meeting in progress.
We saw your vote on your green sheet from your last, your straw vote, excuse me, from your last work session, which said moving the wind over to DEP. So we have attempted to put that into the clarifying amendment as well. There are going to be times by Thursday or maybe even next week that we will have to further tweak this language depending on what this committee decides in regards to its determinations on some of the areas that you'll be further discussing. Some of those will be the mechanics of actually how to provide input at the LURC process and how we mesh that with the department's process. But again, we believe that we're going to be able to make sure that language reflects what your thoughts are in regards to how we do some of those mechanical processes. So please understand that our language may change a little bit. Again, that's dependent very much on how you all undertake your deliberative processes on some of these issues. So with that, Chairman, I don't know how you'd like to approach it. I'm not sure whether going through this on a word-by-word basis would be helpful, or rather you'd like to continue to stay more at the conceptual level for any questions that you might have.
Is there any questions from this committee as of yet, or do you want some time to digest this?
We'll be here throughout, so okay. Whenever you wish.
Representative Edgecombe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The site laws, will the exact same law apply to an organized territory as you currently use for, that you currently have in effect?
Yes. What you'll see in our amendment is that we've said that we already have rules in place on how those standards are met, and that we would be proposing that those projects that would trigger site location review would come to DEP and those same rules would be used.
Thank you.
Representative Black.
Thank you, Commissioner. Do you see this lengthen the permit process, or do you see it streamlining it, taking it from LURC and putting it into the DP?
Our goal...
On NEVA.
Absolutely. And our goals, as we've worked with Ms. Olson, LURC, and Commissioner Beardsley, as both of the departments have worked through this, again, is to make sure that we don't lengthen the permit process, that our goal is to try to make it as efficient as possible.
All set. Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In regards to currently with LURC, there seems to be a large amount of public involvement through public hearings, and there's been some concern that that may not occur if things shift to DEP, as far as the structure and the process being different. And I don't know if you've given that much thought or, how that might be handled or improved upon.
And Representative McCabe, that's one of the areas when I mentioned that we're going to continue to work on some of the language and the mechanics, depending on how the legislature wish for the agencies to proceed in this. Because in some situations, there may not necessarily be a public hearing for an application review and approval at the Department of Environmental Protection. You're correct. So the question, I think, becomes one of how folks want to proceed in regards to transitioning some of the permitting over to us at the department. And again, I step back because I think it will be conceivably different. In some cases right now, there aren't necessarily public hearings for some things that do receive permits even in the unorganized territory. For example, the DEP would go through its own review process for a wastewater discharge license, for an air emission license, which may or may not require public notice and public hearing. So we, too, have within our laws and rules times when public hearings, public notices, all of those are very much required, and we would continue to follow those. However, I do understand that there are some mechanical issues that we need to work through in regards to ensuring input at LURC, in regards to land use, zoning, planning, all of those functions that would stay at LURC, which I don't envision the Department of Environmental Protection being necessarily a part of. So I share your concerns, and I think we need to work through how best to make sure these processes mesh.
Follow up, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And you may not have the answer for all these today, but, you know, I appreciate the discussion, Commissioner. You talked a little bit about sort of a stepped approach to this process. I think last week there was sort of some general consensus around the piece about wind. Mm-hmm. But, you know, since then some people have expressed concerns of the public involvement. And then I see this amendment today, and it's sort of talking about everything, which is helpful for us to look at. But, you know, I'm just concerned that if we shift everything at once or even pieces, that we don't have sort of that seamless transition that we sort of talk about. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate this amendment. It's a lot to digest. In 10 minutes, but
it's
I
also
have
been
some more questions.
A lot for our associated staff to work on.
Sure.
And I think that it's simply trying right now to provide for you a little bit of a sense of where our internal discussions
sure.
have been, and then I do anticipate a number of discussions.
Excellent. Thank you, Commissioner. Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? Representative Thibodeau. Senator Thibodeau.
Yeah, thank you, Senator. Commissioner, thanks for being here. And I just, for clarification, so that I understand and everybody in the audience knows and understands, the threshold for that you're proposing here for DEP involvement, you said that small projects would remain at the under LURC jurisdiction as far as approval. The threshold is essentially the same as all of our organized territories currently, or is this in some way different? Is the relationship the same between the DEP and our local planning board and the DEP and what would be LURC? Is that the same relationship, or is there a different threshold?
The thresholds will remain the same for the Site Location of Development Act, just as it would be if you were in the organized area. Those are, for example, and it's going to change, but it's, for example, changing 3 acres of impervious land, or perhaps 20 acres overall, if you will. So there are the triggers in the Site Location of Development Act that apply in the organized area would apply in the unorganized area.
Right. Well, I think that's an important issue to make sure that folks understand so that, you know, because I think there's some misconceptions out there as far as what we are.
But I do want to make sure, especially for the folks listening, that they that have not had an opportunity to see the amendment, that we have had discussions with LURC on all of our very specific environmental programs.
Mm-hmm.
So you will see language in here relating to the Natural Resources Protection Act or the Site Location of Development Act or the various wind power project laws as well. So we've gone through those, and those thresholds change depending on what you're looking at, whether you're looking at natural resources protection, whether you're looking at wind. But what we attempted to do was, if it applies over here in the organized area and it's a site location of development project, it's still a site location of development project in the unorganized territory.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Well, at the so we're through with the A and B. I gather you're the. Anything else you need to?
No, sir. I will just share that both Ms. Parent and I will be here today. We'll make ourselves available for your work sessions going forward, So as you deliberate on other items today, if there are changes to this, we will continue to work with LARC to try to provide you with those language changes as they would apply to environmental permitting.
Again, as we're thinking through with a new piece of paper in a hand, I'm a visual learner, and I'd like to have time and today to go through what you presented with us. I'm sure some other committee members like to have that, but I don't want to all skedaddling off when we get done here.
Absolutely. I appreciate this is somewhat of a crash course in environmental permitting,
right.
Which makes it very difficult for you.
So when I see a lot of red lines in there, I get a little nervous, and so we got until 7 o'clock.
I usually ask staff to keep it to a page for me. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
we should have known that ahead of time. Representative Gifford.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Commissioner, for being here. I'm just looking at the site location part of it, and it says the Maine Land Use Regulation Commission. I think this is a concern of a lot of people. In consultation with the department, shall annually review. Now, that used to be just 10 years. Now, you're going to review the site development plans annually? Review the land use standards? Is that different than what's been done in the past?
I would have to double check, but I think in that case we were simply trying to allocate language to a particular place in the statute that we thought might make sense. So I can certainly double check with you.
One more piece of that.
Gifford.
Thank you.
Excuse me, just a second. Representative Gifford, could you tell us what page you're on?
I'm on
page 9.
Yeah, page 9. Yep.
Page 9.
Section 17 at the very bottom. Sorry about that.
Last paragraph.
Great.
Representative Gifford, thank you. Ms. Olson said it is existing language.
Okay.
We are just proposing to move it from one section of law to another section of law.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Anyways, is it the... how to say this? I'd like to have a chance to look this over. We have some other things to go through. I'm not sure how we went much faster than what we thought. I think have a chance today to take a look at this. And if we keep you on hold here, I'm not sure how far down we're going to get with the list we have. I think maybe quite a ways.
Oh, Senator, I'm at your beck and call, so that's fine.
Where's Senator Saviello? Did you just hear that?
Thank you.
All right. Commissioner Sandra Snyder has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of things. For me, what would be helpful is having sort of an example of a project that currently is under LURC and walking through through with us how that works. So I can, as Senator Sherman said, I can visualize how this is going to be different. To me, maybe this is just because I like to do things for a reason. So for me, I need to understand why this is going to be better and what are the differences. So, you know, because I've had, and no offense to DEP, but a lot of the same people who complain about LURC complain about DEPs. I need to understand how this is going to change and what is going to change and why it's better. Those are the things that I sort of need to understand. So taking maybe a project now, if it were to come forward today under current law, how that would work and how it will work under this new concept. And why it's better.
Surely. And part of that answer can also be answered to you by Ms. Olson as well.
Yeah.
In regards to that. Let me start with how if a large project came forward today that would trigger the Site Location of Development Act right now, and it's in the unorganized territory,
mm-hmm.
For most of that project, it would be reviewed by the Land Use Regulatory Commission. there may be parts of that project that even today the Department of Environmental Protection would review. That may be an air emission license. It might be a wastewater discharge license, for example. Going forward, what we're saying is that type of large project, rather than going through the Land Use Regulatory Commission process, but then still maybe having to come to DEP for perhaps two other types of permits associated with a very large, complex project, instead, it would come over to DEP. LURC would ensure to us that that big project is in the correct zone and is in a compatible area that they had already planned for or is part of their work. But as far as all of the environmental permitting, it would be done at the department, which is how we think would be best to provide a more efficient and streamlined process from one state government agency or quasi-agency, if you will, to a sister agency. So that's what we're trying to accomplish here for folks.
We have a follow-up?
Well, sure.
And I know you sort of touched on this a little bit about that we may need to address the public input piece and the because one of the things that has got caused a lot of people angst in the past was the intervener status on projects. Is that going to remain the same, just being transferred over to DEP, and would it be the same as far as it, or do you envision it to be the same? Maybe it's not the same, and maybe it's something that we have to map out here.
Made no changes to intervener status for the site location for any of the language that you see in here. If a large, complicated project is proposed in the unorganized territory under this proposal, just as if it was proposed in Falmouth, Maine, if you will, for example, part of that review is still done at the municipal level if you're in Falmouth. Part of that review in some cases will still be done here by LURC and its work in regards to land use and zoning issues. The environmental aspects of that project will be undertaken by DEP. We're not proposing changes to intervener status, to other areas of whether or not somebody can participate in that. And as well, please bear in mind that state law for the Board of Environmental Protection also has requirements that certain types of projects clearly require it go to the Board of Environmental Protection, where that's the citizen board that obviously oversees those types of hearings and decisions on a number of large, significant projects. So there would be that level of input as well.
Senator, all set?
Well, unless, does anybody else have a question?
No, floor is yours.
Then I have another question, which is the funding piece. So all of a sudden, you're tasked with doing a lot of additional work that you haven't had to do before. So my question is, are you going to get funding from fees, or how are you going to pay for all of this additional work?
Ms. McLean at the public hearing has made sure that folks understood that the administration is committing that we do get the necessary resources in regards to whatever is transitioned over to us from LURC. And yes, in some cases there would be fees, just as there would be today, fees if you submit an application to DEP. So we believe that we're going to be able to address those, and we thank the administration for making sure that there will also be a commitment to those resources for us.
Well, that's great. I'm glad that the administration commits to that, but that's going to have to go through legislative approval, I would assume, through a budgetary process.
Yes.
Well, do we have any cost estimates on what we're talking about here?
I think that until such time as we know what the committee is actually proposing to us, that's how we as a department usually undertake a fiscal impact review.
Okay.
So once I know what you're actually proposing to transfer from one agency to another, then we'll be able to determine how we best make sure that those resources are transferred from one agency to another, if that's the case. So we will certainly work through that particular detail, yes.
Okay, because, I mean, I don't think that's a small detail. I think funding of this has been a pretty – it's been very murky, and I understand where you're coming from because we really don't have an – we don't have
Senator Schneider is a commissioner who oversees 410 personnel in four regional office locations. Funding is always a critical detail to me,
Yeah. And we obviously we don't want to shortchange you, especially if you're taking on a lot of additional work. So thank
you. I actually don't think this is going to necessarily be a lot of additional work. There aren't necessarily a significant number of site location of development projects that, at least between discussions with Ms. Olson and I, that we've been able to identify in the past. So I don't think necessarily it's going to be, in some cases, a huge, changeover. But we are, we'll work through and make sure that we are appropriately staffed and resourced.
Okay, thank you.
Or asked if you wanted to make a comment from in my left ear here. In terms of finance, I had one before that, if I may, Commissioner. We know these different projects have been funded in some way, and somewhere there's money items where they were funded and how much it took. I wouldn't want you to go back and look at all those, but I would it's safe to say that the projects that were cited, money and hours you went in, or work went, those are all available somewhere in the books of LURC or DEP.
For large projects?
Right, large projects. And the small projects are going to be what the small projects always were, right?
For LURC?
Yes.
We do, I think this relates to the earlier question about funding, which is that we do have what's called an extraordinary project fee, which is a processing fee. And for the largest projects that we deal with, the trigger is if an individual staff person will spend 4 months or more of their time on a project, then that triggers special fees that go directly to the processing of the application. They aren't deposited to the general fund. It's just for that application, and extra is returned to the applicant at the end of the process. I think that the bulk of the projects that we would be talking about, and I agree with Commissioner Aho that it's probably a relatively small number, at least in the short term, would have triggered that extraordinary fee. And so my sense is that most likely would have been funded through a fee to the applicant. And that will be up to Commissioner Aho in consultation with the legislature about how to apply any of their special fee provisions. I think that piece is another piece that we'll continue to work on as we better understand the committee's intent. We certainly have records of prior permitting actions where the extraordinary fee provision has been invoked. I can tell you they run anywhere from, $40,000 or $50,000. They tend to be, for wind projects, they tend to be in the $40,000 or $50,000 to a little bit over $100,000 range. Obviously, for Plum Creek, it was much more significant. So that gives you kind of a general sense of where those fees were. So I think, if I may, it might also be important to note that we are talking about, at least as I understand it this time, projects that would be located outside of concept plans. And so the universe of what's a site law project that's outside of a concept plan, is going to be relatively limited.
Thank you. Any other follow-up? So you'll be available to take questions together. Senator Schneider.
Thank you. Could you just give me an example of that?
Of a type of project that's outside of a concept?
Yeah.
So if you had a large retail establishment that had significant parking lots that came to 3 acres in size or met the structural limit, a very large, for us anyway, a large subdivision is it 15 lots and 20 acres, I think, is the trigger in site law. So if there was a subdivision that was, let's say, a 30-lot subdivision, you know, over 40 acres or something like that, that would, the primary permit would be issued by DEP with some involvement from work on the pieces that are land use permitting as opposed to environmental permitting, as Commissioner Ajo so ably described earlier. Another example might be an industrial facility. I think you used that example mm-hmm. earlier. Mm-hmm. The kinds of things that would not be included, you know, specifically, obviously, Plum Creek is one of the big issues that people have spoken about as far as permitting coming up for LORC in the next 30 years. And that is certainly something that's in the concept plan, and as the Reform Commission report was produced, and I think as the bill was produced at this time, we're understanding that that's meant to be stay within LARC because of the contractual nature of the arrangement between the agency and the developer. Mm-hmm. However, the committee, of course, could change direction on that, and I'd be happy to provide you with any information or explore with you what that might mean. But that's my understanding at this time, is that hotels and, you know, those sorts of things that would exist within a concept plan would stay with the Land Use Regulation Commission. Is that consistent with your understanding?
That's consistent. Once in a great while, there may be a permit that might be needed within a concept plan area. An air emission license probably is the best example. That is something that the department today, as well as going forward, would be the ones that issue that. But our understanding is the concept plans stay with Laura.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just along those lines, the when you start out with a project, now you're saying you're not going to see many big projects. That's the issue of money, seems to me, is handled by some sort of tax, if you will, if I can say that, on these large projects. Is there any change? Would this, in turn, change any of the smaller permit by rules? So that's going to stay the same.
We have not proposed any changes to our current application fees that we have at the Department of Environmental Protection for any category of any permit. There is no change in our amendment to you or in your bill either. So those categories and those levels would still be the same.
And I asked this one, you may not want to answer it, but you mentioned the fear of what the committee might do, and it wasn't the fear. And this is probably a leading question, obviously. What would we do that would impact your budget in a big way?
You know, that's the type of question that I could really enjoy answering. Right now, how about if I answer it this way for you? If, as the committee deliberates through these particular items, and if there is something that I think would impact my budget in a big way, would make me seek amendments to change application fees or whatever, I will highlight those to you. Otherwise, right now, I am confident with the commitment that Ms. McLean and the administration have made, that the resources will be there for whatever is decided at the end of the day here.
Okay, thank you. Hey,
thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm not sure if you're involved. The next two, we have LURC permitting activities, and a breakdown of types of permits issued by LURC. This breakdown should be helpful in ACF's consideration of activities to be potentially be delegated to a county for permitting. So, Jill, you're handling Part C here.
Well, I think Samantha Horn-Olson will probably want to come back. Megan's passing out a memo that Samantha and LORC staff prepared in response to these questions. And that first, under C, as you recall, in the bill.
You could just wait until they all have
sure.
that, if we may.
Okay. And Samantha, can you come back up, please?
Thank you.
Yes.
Okay, I think everyone has a copy. Jill, go ahead.
Okay. So under C, under the information request, this came up in regard to Section 19 of the bill of LD 1798, where the delegation to the counties, and it reads, the commission may establish standards by which authority may be delegated to a county upon request of the county commissioners to approve with conditions or deny applications to conduct specific activities requiring a permit and to enforce compliance with the permit. And members of this committee had questions about, well, what does that mean? Again, this is not the county provisional optic provision. This is just going forward. If a county is willing and comes to LURC and says, you know, we can do permitting for certain types of activities. This section 19 gives the LURC discretionary authority to delegate that responsibility. And the question came up and said, well, what kinds of permits would you envision? So Samantha's pulled together kind of a range of the different types of permits they do. If this is something the committee wants to pursue, if you want to leave section 19 in, but you're not quite comfortable not knowing what, I mean, you could. There are different ways that you could approach that in terms of a directive to come back and tell us which types of activities, or you could look at them in more detail now and specifically state which ones you might be willing to authorize.
Easy to ask, Samantha. You solo movies where they're tasked and they see the burning message, and so we have a burning message for you. So have you had a chance to see what Jill put together here?
Oh, that's actually my memo to you.
Oh, it is? Okay.
Yeah. And I,
so you must know,
to be honest, my staff's memo to you. I thank them very much. And Appendix A, on if you look at, it's labeled as page one of Appendix A, is a list, it's double-sided. It's just simply a list of all the different permit types that LURC issues. And I thought that this might be the most helpful place to start because you were interested in the types of permits that we issue. You know, if you have questions about any of the specific types, I'd be happy to try to answer them, or Rod Fala, the acting director of our permitting division, is here as well. I won't read them all to you, of course. And I think the question that you asked, though, was, you know, what would be delegated? And my understanding of the language as it exists is that that's a process that would be worked through by the commission, looking at the particulars of how their staff operate and how the counties are interested in operating, and understanding the ramifications of things like, you know, how can we provide good customer service so you don't get customers having to go to more than one agency, and how to do it in an efficient manner so everyone understands how appeals work. And so my understanding of the language currently is that that is something that would be worked out by the commission.
Okay, let's take about a minute and go down through these permits while we have them. And if you have any questions, we can work through those. You, Samantha, you'd leave it to the discretion of the two groups to work these out as to how they want to shift these around. Is that what you're saying?
That's the current language. I think there are some considerations that get down into the weeds a little bit about functionally how would all this work. I think if you have strong concerns about that, you know, we certainly can do that with you. But I guess I'd want to check in with you as a committee and see if you really wanted to go into those weeds before I take you there and start to see you, you know, not wanting to go there. So I'd be happy to do whatever is helpful to you in terms of detail. But I think what's in the bill today could work in terms of you delegating that task of sorting through the particulars to the commission.
So after you those are sorted out, then do you come back to us, or is that internal, to do it internally?
That's your choice, Senator.
The way it's written right now in the bill is the committee, the the commission would have the ability to work out an arrangement with the county requesting. I think that maybe really the two of them would get together and say, yes, this makes sense, this doesn't. And the way it's written right now, it wouldn't have to come back to you. It would be up to the commission and the county to agree on what types of applications they were comfortable delegating.
This is just a blank
Senator Snyder and Representative Gifford.
My apologies. This is just a blanket moving forward that the commission will determine which ones they want to take on and which ones they don't.
Which ones they want to delegate to the county?
Yeah.
Yes, that's how I read it.
That's
what
it's written.
Yeah.
Representative Gifford.
My opinion, and this is just my thoughts, but if you and the DEP are talking about making a determination who handles it, bring it back to us?
This is separate from the site law issue in that the site law permits, I think the current direction is that the site law permits, if that's the wish of the legislature, we'll go to the DEP with LURC involvement. There's land use permitting pieces and there's environmental permitting pieces, and we'd be contributing to their process in doing the land use permitting pieces. But that's the really big projects. I think what this section addresses is kind of everything else, that there's this other universe of projects that could be as small as a shed or they could be a more significant, and that what this language does is give the commission discretionary authority to come up with a set of rules that are standards, not rules, but standards, I suppose, that that by which they could delegate authority for permitting and for enforcement to the county in a way that made sense to the commission. And it's essentially, as I read it, it's everything up to the point where some other agency is doing it. So it does not include the site law, because that would be clearly in law that the DEP would be doing that. The commission would not have authority to delegate those to the county. I'm sorry, did I just confuse you?
Very easy today to do that.
One example would be, say, a building permit. I mean, a county may come to LURC and say, gee, we have the resources. We could do building permits for a residential building. And the way the language is written right now, the commission could do that. If this committee thinks that's too much authority to give the if you want to carve out certain types of permits, then you could do that, or you could in unallocated law direct the commission to come back with you with suggestions for which types of permits might be appropriate. It's one of those things, but it could change from county to county with what that county's resources are, what the demand for permits are.
Representative Gifford?
No, that wasn't my intent. I think I like that idea of you communicating with the counties and making that determination. That kind of streamlines the process and not involve us unless absolutely necessary.
Timberlake.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with you, Representative Gifford, but I would want something in there that if a county decides that they would like to do the building permit, but maybe LURC doesn't think they want to give that up, that the county has some methodology of being able to come back to us and say, listen, we've asked to do this. They don't think we have the technology to do it. We think we do. How do we rule on that? I can see this battle coming of territory of who covers what, and I would like to make sure that's clear before we proceed.
So make a note of that. I have a couple quick questions with a quick run through on this permit action types. We have one on hydropower permit, which we don't do much anymore, I think. And that's in here, which sounds like a rather large project. The other one's on the wetlands. We're talking about county wetlands alteration permit. Isn't that basically a LURC that's been taken away from LURC anyway, right?
No. We're still administering the Natural Resources Protection Act if it's not associated with a site law permit.
Okay.
Well, I mean, we are doing site law at the moment, too, but I mean in the course of the discussion that's unfolded today, the only time that the Natural Resources Protection Act permits would be done by DEP is when they also occur with another permit that DEP is doing, such as site law. The hydropower permit, those could be very large or they could be very small. We're seeing more micro hydro, so people who live near a stream wanting to put a small generator in the stream to power their home if they're off the grid, that sort of thing. So it could be any number of sizes.
Okay, thank you. Senator Snyder.
So I'm just looking down this list, and for example, large lot division plan. That's not going to be one, right? Because
right,
so are there any that we can just sort of cross off like that one where it's not they're not going to be a it's going to be more like the like maybe a building permit and it would be for you know like it looks like fairly simple projects.
I think that the consideration that you know some of the staff raised with me, and I'd be happy to have Rod Fowler talk with you about this as well since he's in this day-to-day, is that we just want to be thoughtful about how we approach if there's a, like if someone's coming in for a project and they'd like to use the county permitting services, we want to make sure we don't set it up in such a way that they can get part of their project permitted by the county, but the other part of their project they can't. And it might require more than one permit on a given project.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's a lot of dependencies
mm-hmm.
that also have to do with customer service issues. We don't. The last thing I want to do is have someone
right.
come
right.
to us and we say,
right.
you know, that we
right.
have to go to different places. So
right.
I'm a little hesitant to kind of today say, this one, not this one, this one, not this one. But if you have a kind of an overarching theory of how this should be approached, we could work something up. It's just that I think...
Well, I'm not... I'll be very frank with you. All this information for me, I don't know how the rest of them... I never wanted to be on the planning board because this to me, first of all, it's not my area of expertise, and it's a lot of new information, frankly, this is why I think planning help for people who serve on LURC is so important, because all of us, I know, are sitting here looking at, or many of us, anyway, are sitting here, and it's looking at very new information. And I am trying to come up with thoughtful, deliberative, good solutions, and I feel like I really don't. I feel like I'm, in the dark, and this is really a lot of. And I don't blame you all. You've prepared very good information, but it is a lot to expect from people who have never served on a planning board or anything like that. Because I want to know what happens if. If we do this, what are the pros and the cons? I want to hear from people who are, like, thinking that this is the best way to do it, and I want to hear from people who are really concerned about if we go this direction. I want to hear both sides so I can make a thoughtful decision, because I'm really not grasping what the unintended consequences could be if we start saying, oh, yeah, okay, you can do... we'll say building permit, yeah, they can do that. And we'll go Great Ponds permit, yeah, they can do that. I have no idea.
Right.
I'm like in the dark. I'm like, it's like shooting with blindfold on, you know?
And I think that makes a lot of sense because it does mean understanding all the intricacies of how the permitting works, which is a lot for a legislative body to take on, which is why you hire staff for
right.
the commission. And so there's a couple of ways potentially to approach this. I think some of the positives that people have mentioned have to do with the ability to, down the road, have county staff in locations that are in a different place than the LURC office and maybe increase accessibility and have a kind of a local face. I think there's also some philosophical pros that have been advanced in terms of, you know, how the that the county has more direct involvement. But
I think we're heading in a direction where we may have her come back, and I think you would want to put some things together for us, so for another day.
Can I make a suggestion maybe that if you're interested in seeing how this would work, but you're concerned about making sure that the outcome is what you would like to see in the end, you know, it is possible to do this kind of thing through a rulemaking process in such a way that it's public and people get to comment, and then it comes back to you. And we could put something together for you, but I'm really concerned that if I tell you today that on Thursday I can provide you with a suggestion for how this all would work, we're really creating a situation where, like, one staff person, without the input of the counties and without the input of the commission, is creating a system that may or may not work in the end. And so I just don't want to give you that kind of a false
Well, the other thing.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other thing that just occurred to me is, like, the counties themselves, as far as I'm aware, don't have any planning. It would be like, what function do county government have to say, I can take this on? That's what I don't understand.
Well, I think when you look at Section 19, it's not so much as planning. It's the approving, using the standards that LURC has, and then approving a permit.
Right, but who there has, right now, I don't understand if county government has that.
Well,
so go ahead, and then I want to suggest something.
I just think, to be clear on what Section 19, and this is one on your green sheet, this is the third one down that you wanted some more clarification on. This is something, if the committee's not comfortable doing it now, I mean, you could do unallocated law saying for the commission or the new commission to talk about this and bring a proposal back to this committee. The way it's written right now, the commission would just be establishing standards to delegate, and then that county would have the authority to issue permits. But it wouldn't be, I mean, they wouldn't be changing land use zones. They wouldn't be doing the standards for the permits either. They would just be, yes, we can take your application. We can check and make sure that you meet these standards that are in LURC's rules. So it's...
That's another way to go. I think they probably are not going to get this one solved today. Samantha, you talked about another option would be to do this by rulemaking. And how would that process work? We wouldn't get it done this year.
If the commission were directed to conduct rulemaking, given all the other rulemaking we're likely to be directed to conduct, it would be good if we had a little time to do it. But we could, if either they could be routine technical rules or they could be major substantive rules. We could work with the commission as we're about to have probably some transition in the commission, and so we most likely want to have a good core of commissioners there, and then we could start to work with them and get input from the counties and the public in general about how these systems might work, put it together as a proposal, take public comment, and then complete the rulemaking, and the rulemaking would specify the responsibilities and rights of the counties, where the appeals would go, how requests from the counties would be made, you know, that sort of thing. So it's, you know, as with any other rulemaking, I think that the difference between established standards and making rules is just the level of review and public input.
So we have those two options. We won't maybe take them today, but that certainly rulemaking sounds attractive sitting here today, because that's a process you go through, get the input, which Senator Snyder is talking about, and so we'd have that give and take if that were done by rulemaking. That's
one option.
Okay.
Senator.
Representative Thibodeau.
Thank you, Senator.
I know you have four senators.
I'll raise you two representatives.
Two representatives.
I would throw out to you that this is all hypothetical. We haven't had a single county suggest at this point that they even want to take on these responsibilities. So rather than trying to pass all this out, I think we might be far better off to just insert language making it somewhat permissive for the counties and the new board, if the issue comes forward, to work out these details rather than us trying to put it all in statute, when, quite frankly, not a single county has given any indication that they want to be responsible for any of this stuff on their own. So I think it's, you know, I think we're having a conversation about something that may and probably would never happen, and I think that we'd be far better served to worry about the stuff that we know is going to happen rather than this issue, because I think we are turning this over to this new LURC commission to be responsible for issuing the permits, and if a county comes forward with a plan, we can make it permissive for that this new commission to develop some sort of arrangement with the counties if they deem appropriate. But I don't think we have to. Right now, we're turning it over to this new LURC commission, not to the county station is permanent.
So do we, we'll table this for now.
That's what the section in the bill does right now, is what you're describing.
Yeah. I just think this is...
Okay, let's table this and put on our list semi-bucket.
Semi-bucket? Seven. I'm all right with semi-bucket.
Semi-bucket. So do we need a motion for that, or just duly noted it was in the bucket brigade?
Still in the weight column.
It
still has weight in it.
So weight column. So if we're done with C, permitting activities, I gather that ended that. Rulemaking authority under LURC. And we please characterize the various types of rules. The LURC adopts including rules that submitted to legislature now under 12 MRS 685A. So do we have something along those lines, Jill?
Yes, and here, again, Samantha has she's addressed this at the bottom of the first page of her memo. She talks about where they do have major substantive rules now, and I'm looking to see, maybe Samantha, you could jump in here and just talk about as you recall, at the last work session we talked about LURC's rulemaking authority, and there is a body of rules that they bring back to you. They're not officially designated major substantive. They can adopt them, bring them back to you. If you disapprove, then you can ask that those be invalid. But I think on the second, these are the ones here. Oh.
Do you want me to just go through them?
Yeah, I'd like you to go through the different types. What you're thinking of here is, are there rules that LURC does now that you would want to make major substantive and have go through the formal major substantive review rather than the informal process that's done now?
Okay. Samantha, you want to go through the bottom of this page? Your work.
It starts there. There are where it says LURC rules fall into four categories, and then it lists the four categories below. I'll just briefly describe each category, and then if you have questions about those, I'd be happy to answer them. The first is major substantive rules, which is what you're all very used to. They're fees, regulations for administrative regulations for hydropower projects. Are the two types of rules that are major substantive. Then there's routine technical, which again is a category that you're very familiar with. That is delegation of authority to staff. So in other words, what the commission has decided the staff can handle at the staff level. Chapter 4, rules of practice, which is our procedural rules for how we handle processing an application. Chapter 5 is rules for the conduct of public hearings, so it's just rules about how you go about holding a public hearing. Our metallic mineral exploration rules and the rules about reestablishing commission jurisdiction, that's the when a municipality wants to leave the jurisdiction, and then if they do not continue to have an effective land use planning function, then the commission can reestablish jurisdiction. Now, categories 3 and 4 are definitely not plain vanilla. They're the unique types of rules that are distinct in LARP jurisdiction. Number three is routine technical rules that are submitted to the legislature. And these are done as routine technical rules. We submit the rulemaking package to the legislature in the next session. So you all, we sent anyway a package to the committee in January that outlined what the rulemaking we had done in the prior year. And at that time, the statute authorizes you to accept, amend, reject a whole rule or a portion of the rule. And my understanding is that you don't need that you can do that without having to have had a bill in advance of the session, that, you know, you can do it at that time. I think that has not, that provision has not been often exercised, but it has been exercised where the committee of jurisdiction wrote a letter back to the commission and said, we're not satisfied with these rules. Please reconsider section X, Y, and Z. Here are our concerns. And then we went back out to rulemaking. And the ones that fit into that category are Chapter 10, Land Use Districts and Standards. And an example of that is the type of rule that Representative Black brought to our attention. And through a bill, you all have changed, you've directed us to do rulemaking to change a standard around maple syrup processing operations so that the setback provisions don't, the 1,000-foot setback doesn't apply anymore. So that's an example of the Chapter 10 Land Use Districts and Standards rules. Many of the rulemaking instances in that are fairly routine and are, you know, adjustments as we go along. Sometimes they are significant. Sometimes it's consistency with what DEP has done on a Natural Resource Protection Act issue. So there are, you know, different levels of significance that happen with that Chapter 10 rulemaking. And then there are several others, but frankly, I think the Chapter 10 is the one that is, comes up most often in that category. And I think that the benefit of this very unusual rulemaking provision is that because most of what we do there is fairly routine, it can move through without having to come back to you every session for a definitive approval in a bill. But if there is something in that process that concerns you, you can pick up on it in the next legislative session and deal with it at that time. Number four. The category four is routine technical rules addressing district boundaries and land use maps. And this is zoning, pure and simple. It's when someone has a let's say, a house lot. Part of it is zoned as a wetland, and it was zoned in error, and they want to change that boundary to where it really should be. They come to us with a zoning petition. It's also when Plum Creek wants to do a 400,000-acre concept plan, they come to us with a zoning petition. So it's the on-the-ground zoning. Because those are treated more like permit applications than a rule that affects the entire jurisdiction, those do not come back to you. They've got special provisions for how we process them. They're still done under the APA because we're a state agency and we have to do it that way. We're not under law as a municipality, but it's a modified process so that the only people that get notified are the people that are directly affected, not the entire state. And it doesn't come back to you for approval. So those are the four types of rules that we process. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you have about that.
Representative Edgecombe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At the top, it says Chapter 4 and then Chapter 5 coming down. Is this the rule that's holding up the roadblock that blocks the state of Maine from mining the billions of dollars in gold that we have in the unorganized territory? Which, it's not a joke. I'm serious.
I understand there are some significant mineral resources, especially up in northern Maine. Yeah. It's the rules for metallic mineral exploration, I believe, were done jointly with DEP, and it's anyone can put in a permit application to explore that. We're happy to work with people to make sure that whatever development they're proposing with regard to metallic mineral mining would meet the standards and could be allowed. So I mean, those are rules that pertain to that kind of activity. I guess I don't know that the LURC regulation is what's holding up mining. We'd be happy to talk to anyone who wanted to do that kind of development. But
is there something beyond that that's holding them, or is this Chapter 13 that again is a roadblock? Because that's what I understand, but the problem is there's a roadblock there to prevent that from happening.
From what I've been told in recent times, and I don't know this for certainty myself, that the regulations in most of the country have also evolved, and so Maine's regulations are not particularly out of step with other places in the country. If there are changes, so I don't have any information that our rules are holding up mining.
Okay.
If that is the case, and companies would like to make that known, I mean, we certainly can consider a rule change. But I'm not aware that that's what's holding up mining.
Is there any way you could get any information on that for us?
I certainly can ask the Bureau of Geology and Natural Areas if they have any information on that, as they do oversee the research and information on mineral resources in the state.
Okay. Thank you.
Excuse me, Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Edgecombe's questions just like piqued my interest in sort of this gold exploration. I had someone ask me, actually, I think it was someone from Trout Unlimited this fall, asking if we'd seen an increase in Somerset County streams of people panning for gold and how that works. And I actually saw that in Skowhegan for the first time. I've seen a guy, he's actually panning for gold. And is there a request at all for access to streams and things increasing now with the interest of small-scale gold exploration? Nothing large like in Aroostook County.
I don't know if it's increasing or not. In a minute, I'll ask Rod behind me if he has any sense. But you know, there is mineral, there's gold panning and suction dredging and that sort of thing that occurs in rivers. And I have heard of people doing that in recent years and inquiring about the standards and that sort of thing. So it is occurring.
The Rangeley area.
Yeah.
I haven't seen anything coming in from Somerset yet. There's some cases where if it's hand panning, where there's no mechanized usage, then really it's not. It's just by standard. It would be an issue. But we have seen some things coming through the Rangeley office.
Do you want to say anything about mineral resources or?
Aroostook County was mentioned, and there are rules. You can only use so much horsepower. You can't disturb the roots along the stream. So there are all sorts of rules about panning. And then I have a granddaughter who's 5 years old, and she was above Mexico Rumford, and they were panning, and they found a little itty-bitty flake. And if you talk to me afterwards, I'll tell you where that was. Any other comments, thoughts? I do have one on the APA. That's the Administrative Procedures Act, right? And that gives certain standards that you have to go by to do any of these. So
that's correct.
I assume most people know that. So we're done with the LURC rulemaking. And Samantha, is there anything else you need to add? Want to add? Like get off the hot seat, maybe.
Is that it for me?
No, I think she certainly has answered the questions you asked. I would ask that the next on your list is paragraph E, the timber harvesting activity.
And we're going to
skip that one.
That's the language review, right? So we're going to leave that.
Yeah, you do a language review. That's where the piece that's related to LD 1739. And Bob Doran from Maine Revenue Services is here. And Marcia McGinnis, I believe.
For the funding piece?
I think most of the questions, I think Bob Doran, this was the question of, it relates to section 26 in the bill. And people had questions about, this has to do with the county opt-out. And again, remember, the way the bill is, this wouldn't happen for 3 years, and Representative Foster's amendment actually puts it out for 5 years. But if a county in the future were to assume responsibility for land use planning and regulation within the UT and the
for those areas that Lurkin provides those land use services for. This section 26 would say the money they're assessed now for land use planning services, instead of going into the general fund, that would go back to the counties. And people on this committee had questions about how much money would that be. So if Bob Dorn could come up, and he has some handouts for you. He is in charge of, he's with Maine Revenue Services. He's you're the supervisor for property taxes.
Indian Organized Territory.
Before you get started, I have this.
And then there were other questions that he may or may not be able to answer, but questions about if the counties do take on these responsibilities, how much, who's basically the question was, whose taxes would go up and how would they adjust? And we may want to save that for another day, the discussion of the municipal cost component, but I'm sure Bob might be able to give you the basics of how that works, and then some actual numbers. I posed to him if the three biggest counties, the counties with the largest area in LURC, came out, how would that impact?
Okay, thank you. Just at some point we need there's a municipal, we're going to have the other day, the municipal, I can't speak anymore, component, and we have folks here that were going to do this and on the audit side. We also have an office, someone could do today. I know we have a county commissioner from Rustic County that's involved in financing, Paul Underwood, and if we get to the financial point, if the will of the committee, we'd like to hear from a man who drove 500 miles round trip to get here. So I think, having said that, I think you're on.
Good afternoon. My name is Bob Doran. I'm Deputy Director of the Property Tax Division at Maine Revenue Service. My primary duty in the office is to oversee the assessing and collecting of property taxes in the unorganized territory. By the unorganized territory, remember that's a subset of LURC's jurisdiction. The unorganized territory is that part of Maine that has no municipal government. LURC's jurisdiction is all the unorganized territory, as well as 40 municipalities who LURC is planning and permitting for currently. So what I've given to you, I'll walk you through that. There are two funding revenue streams that I'm going to talk about.
And just are folks all set to start? You look down through this. I don't mean to interrupt, but I'd like to read this for the folks out and listening to this. It says, request from Maine Revenue Services and LURC staff to provide the loss of revenue to the general fund, if I understand, if the county chooses to opt out of the LURC and assume Land Use Planning Regulatory Commission. So you're answering a very specific question for you.
That's exactly right, Senator.
Okay, thank you.
The two revenue streams that I've given you some examples of, and I'll walk you through in a minute, are for funding for the unorganized territory LURC's budget, that's formula in statute in Title 12, where essentially the state valuation of all the unorganized territory multiplied times a decimal, 0.00014, results in a number that is LURC's budget that we will raise in the unorganized territory property tax commitment in our next commitment. And that value is one that does appear in the municipal cost component legislation that the fiscal administrator annually puts together before taxation committee to approve all state and county agency budgets who act in a municipal-like role for the unorganized territory. The other stream is the same type of a process for the 40 municipalities who are under LURC's jurisdiction presently. Their state valuation is multiplied times 0.00018, which is 0.018%, times each of those municipalities' state valuation for that year. The municipal services side of my office, not my side that acts essentially as the assessor and tax collector's office for the unorganized, but the municipal services side annually sends out bills to those 40 municipalities. In fact, they've just gone out recently based on that formula of their state valuation times that decimal number results in essentially a fee that they have to pay. They pay to Maine Revenue Service. That money, once paid by the municipalities, is then rolled into the general fund. So these are the two streams that I'm going to talk to you about. Looking at the first page, This only speaks to the UT portion of that, not the municipal portion. This is the current form that LURC's funding from UT taxpayers will take this year in the municipal cost component. At the bottom, it's $531,000 and change. That will be LURC's part of the municipal cost component legislation. It's based on the state valuation of all the UT counties times that 0.00014, coming up with those individual county ones, a total of $531,000 or so. That's just from taxpayers in the UT based on this purely formula-driven method of raising money for as a revenue stream for LURC. On the second page, as Jill said, she asked that we remove the three largest counties from the unorganized territory formula to give you a sense of how much money. If those three large counties, Aroostook, Piscataquis, and Somerset, opt out, in other words, LURC would no longer be doing planning and permitting for them, and as some of your legislation proposes doing, those dollars would then be paid to the counties, to each respective county. Of that original $531,000 that will be the amount this year, it would be broken out so that those three counties, those three largest counties, would have sent to them a total of $311,000 of that $531,000, because they are the three largest, they're the largest share of state valuation. So we would deliver to Aroostook County. At the bottom of the page, you can see we would send them, if this were in place now, we would send them $83,000 and change. Piscataquis would get almost $112,000, and Somerset would get around $116,000 from the unorganized territory piece of this only. The next page is the hardest one to get your hands around, but the simplest thing to look at is the top three lines over on the right where you see $114,000, $147,000, $148,000. That assumes, again, that those three counties, Aroostook, Piscataquis, and Somerset, no longer are under LURC's jurisdiction and are doing that role themselves. And it's a combination of the money that comes from the unorganized territory for those three counties, as well as if they assume responsibilities for the municipalities that they currently have. For instance, you can see Aroostook has 13 towns and plantations, Cary, Sear, Garfield. Those ones that currently the municipal services side sends a bill to, just last week, in fact, if those were also taken over by Aroostook County government, then $31,000 of that revenue stream from the 40 municipalities, those that are in Aroostook County, would also go to Aroostook County. Same thing with Piscataquis County, just under $36,000 of the municipal LURC towns in that county. Those funds, if those counties took on those responsibilities for those municipalities as well in their county, they would get that. And again, with Somerset, with the five jurisdictions, plantations, all of them, that would add another $32,800 to what they were getting from the UT revenue stream. So at the very top on the right, if these three counties were opted out of having LURC do their planning and permitting and took those responsibilities on for the unorganized territory in their county, as well as all the municipalities who are currently LURC municipalities in their respective county, then Aroostook County would receive $114,516 this year using factual state valuation numbers this year. Piscataquis, $147,602, and Somerset, $148,738. Those three totaled up are $410,886 of the total that currently is raised through the 40 municipalities this year and the UT. 788. So about 52%, if these three counties were to opt out and take on all responsibilities for planning and permitting in their counties for the municipalities that are under work in their county as well as the UT, about 52% of the total money for those two revenue streams, for the unorganized territory and the 40 municipalities, 52% would go to those three counties. Mm. I know that's a lot to absorb, but Jill picked three big examples, so it would impact the numbers considerably. So in terms of the general fund right now, ultimately, this year, will receive $789,598 from those two revenue streams, from the 40 municipalities who are who are billed by Maine Revenue Service and pay into the general fund, and also the $500,000, $530,000 that we raise in our property tax commitments for just the UT taxpayers. This is for LURC purposes. So $411,000 about would be a reduction from what would flow this year to the general fund if this were to happen in this year, if these three counties were to opt out and take responsibility in lieu of LURC doing it.
Is this, and the money flows into the general fund, what happens to that money? That's just a gift to the...
You've just gone beyond my pay grade, Senator, in terms of how the accounting happens after we collect it. The money flows into the general fund, and from there, maybe Samantha from LURC could describe how that funding then flows back to them. I honestly don't look at any of that beyond our collection of it.
And we still have the education component, too.
Right. But you're not going to worry about that.
Thank you. That's one thing. I'll put that down. I'm not going to worry about that.
Well,
go ahead, Representative McCary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So it's interesting because, if you know, looking at this, if the three big counties go, and you're the fourth county, you end up picking up sort of a lot of the tab if you have the valuation. I think probably the fourth county with the valuations, Franklin County, or no, it's not based on valuation.
No, the county, each of the counties is based on their individual state valuation times that decimal.
Sure.
So Franklin County's share would not change what they have to, what we have to raise for the unorganized territory
would change,
would stay, because the state valuation is fixed for each county. So there's no makeup anyplace else. It's simply the total dollars we would have raised that flowed into the general fund, almost $800,000 this year, if this were the case. About half of that would not flow to the general fund. It would go to these three counties to help them support their planning and permitting process. So everyone else would still pay the same amount as they will have to pay now.
And as far as the valuation of the county, what's is that based on?
Well, this is based on state valuation. As the assessor for the unorganized, consider me like a municipal assessor.
Sure.
My local commitment records generally are different than the state valuation. The municipal services side of property tax annually does a state valuation process for all municipalities in the state as well as the unorganized territory. And that's to bring all values to a theoretical 100%, so the legislature can look at each municipality and the UT's ability to pay its own way. And state valuation, as you probably know, is pretty key to a number of state processes like school subsidy, revenue sharing. In fact, county taxes are based purely on state valuation. It's theoretical 100% of value. That's what these numbers are, and that's what in statute these percent methods of raising LURC budget monies is based on the state valuation, not my local values.
Representative McCain.
How close are we to that 100% evaluation?
In the unorganized?
Yes.
9.4 million acres. I could point to some places where we're right on the nose, other places where we're really not. It's a very large jurisdiction. It's hard to quantify it. We have areas where we're pretty close and areas where we haven't caught up with the market still, waterfront areas, as remarkable as that might seem with the way the real estate market has gone. We have some places that are 100%, some perhaps even slightly over 100% with a downturn of the market. And some waterfront values, we have over 500 lakes we put a front foot value on in the UT, and some of those probably still line up to market value right now.
Well, thank you.
Any other questions? I do have a couple. When you're doing the state's putting the value on this 3.7 billion acres, and I assume the tree growth is in there someplace, that diminishes the value. Do we have some, should be a record someplace of how much of this is in tree growth?
Then in the unorganized territory, I can't speak to those 40 municipalities that self-govern and self-assess. But in the 9.4 million acres of the unorganized territory, about 7.3 million acres of tree growth classified acres.
7.3 out of that?
7.3 million of the 9.4 million.
So what about lands that are in conservation easements and little green squiggles on the map where the Appalachian Club goes and those sorts of things. How's that valued? What's that valued?
Unless there's something that impairs market value, we assess market value. There are certainly is around 1 million acres of the 9.4 million acres in the unorganized that's exempt from value, mostly because of state and federal loan. Baxter State Park is an example. But everything else is valued according to just value, market value, unless it's in one of the current use programs, like tree growth. The UT is still primarily a commercial forest land and probably will be for the rest of my life and beyond, I expect.
And the issue of valuing lots around lakes, there was a bill that you probably don't want to comment on, a takings bill that had people in front of the judiciary for hours and hours and hours, or line there. When you do a lake and the 6 miles of lake, is every portion of that 6 miles called place to put a cottage or something, or does it actually have to be designated as I got my 3 acres here, or whatever it is, and lots on the lake? How's that dealt with?
I think I'll answer this like any municipal assessor would say. we look at what the market indicates value is for a property every place in the unorganized territory. Waterfront, you look at what willing buyer and willing seller will pay for property, and we value all similar property in the same fashion. On any given lake, we may have, for instance, on Moosehead, I think we have 7 or 8 different front foot values that reflect the quality of the frontage there and what people seem to indicate it's worth to them when they buy it. We base generally our market values on what we see a number of people have paid for in recent years. It's the best indicator of it. So if it has the potential to be developed, we value it in that way. If it's undeveloped, we value it less than if it's developed, just because of that difference of improvements.
I was on a committee a few years ago when Great Northern offered some of the lots up for sale, as you brought it up. And we don't know what sky they pulled those values out of, but they seem rather high at the time. You couldn't buy them just as a hand and sell type of thing. Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So a question while we're talking about these lakefront lots and things. As far as new construction, how good are we as far as sharing information between LURC permits and the assessing component as far as bringing those valuations?
We, I've been in this job 13 years now, excuse me, and we've worked pretty closely with LURC. We consider it a sister agency. We have people from LURC in our office looking at property record cards pretty regularly to find out information on things they've discovered. And as well, they provide us with, on a regular basis, permits that people get for building a new camp or a garage or whatever.
Sure.
And that's one of our methods. Just like in a municipality, you would have the same thing. The assessor looks to permits to see where he or she has to go look at new property.
Sure.
And we use that resource very actively. And Mark has done a great job of providing us that. We share demographic information from our billing system with LURC. Remember, property tax law is almost all not protected by confidentiality. You can come into my office and look at 99% of the records that are public. So we share, LURC has access to our billing system database for demographics, looking at ownership changes that they may not be aware of or may have interest in, or splits that we've done. As well, over the years, we've started sharing digitized maps LURC paid for a number of years ago to have all of the unorganized territory, as well as I think it's 40 municipalities, the maps, tax maps, digitized, because they use them for their purposes, and we now share those digitized maps for our purposes. So we've had a pretty good synergy over the years, I think, and it's gotten better as technology has helped us all do our jobs more efficiently. So we do communicate quite a bit on subjects that are of interest to both offices for our different purposes.
Follow up.
One follow-up. It's it's fascinating, I guess, hearing this piece, and I don't know if you've ever given any thought or heard the concept of more of a current use tax base for the UT, but this is a very interesting discussion that makes me think more of that. And why would some of these landowners, retain forested land or forested land around some of these lakes if they're being taxed at the same rate, I guess.
I'm sorry if I didn't make clear on that point. If you have, for instance, tree growth current use land,
sure,
it takes the current use values that the state tax assessor sets each year, pretty low values, maybe a couple hundred dollars an acre,
sure,
regardless of what other value. If it's frontage on Kennebago or Moosehead, a very valuable lake, and it's in tree growth, it's assessed $200 an acre. It's not assessed reflective of the market value of that piece of land, because it's bound by this contractual arrangement with the assessing authority that they are going to use the land for commercial forest products, and if they come out of the program voluntarily or through some change in use, they are hit with a penalty that's pretty punitive, quite punitive.
You want to ask that question?
Senator Gray.
Thank you, Senator Sherman.
Yeah.
I'll just be one quick. You just said that if there's a lake in the middle of the unorganized territory and that land is in tree growth around it, all the land that butts around it is still in tree growth, even though you can't cut wood within 250 feet of the water?
Whatever the cutting requirements are, Representative, the law is clear that those lands can be in tree growth even though they're encumbered from cutting because of restrictions in law. Current law, that's how it reads.
But to be in tree growth, don't you have to be able to harvest that forest?
But for that provision in law that allows this situation you're asking about, shorelands can be in tree growth appropriately.
Perhaps legislation, Representative Cray would make.
Different issue.
A whole different
ball. Enough of those days. So, I don't think any other questions. The last thing I have on my paper is and I think this is, you've answered it, a question that's been forwarded through the Maine County Commissioner Association. You're responding to us, to the Maine County Commissioner Association. Is that a separate one?
Right. That's a separate one.
And okay.
Before we go on to that one, and I think just so it, for the information that Mr. Dworin just brought, if you can recall back a couple of weeks ago when you were in the taxation committee and they you received this annual report, do you recall? It's the annual report on LURC funding. And LURC gets, their funding is general fund. They get a general fund appropriation. And the last table on there, and I should have photocopied this for you. Megan may have your funding, but we can photocopy it if it would be helpful. But the columns in there, they look like the money that's brought into the general fund. It comes from the two pieces that Bob just talked about, from the UT and from the towns that use LURC. That's one stream of revenue. And then there's the fees, the permit fees, and the fines that come in from LURC but also go to the general fund. So the annual report that you get looks at, like, what's their general fund appropriation, and then there's a column that just has the difference, okay? So I think the information that Mr. Dworin provided, it tells you what money would not be going to the general fund, and then it also tells you what funding those counties could count on to support those doing those planning services. And then, you can get into a whole other discussion of is that enough or not enough, or what will the other tax impacts be if that's not enough to do it. But the information, just so you're aware that, it is, the LURC gets all its funding from a general fund appropriation. And you do get a report yearly, and the balance, it differs from, like, when I look for, well, for 2011-2012, the general fund appropriation was $1.83 million. And the difference, what wasn't paid, what didn't come in from this cost component and from fees and application fees and fines, is the difference was about $865,000. Okay? But I don't know if you want this. It may be helpful to have this in front of you. It may not. But just that's... You got to think of it's all general fund, but then on the side, this is the money coming in attributable to these different revenue streams.
Okay, Senator Snyder, question about the
Jill's.
So, a large chunk, the 800 plus 1,000, is just simple general fund appropriation, not coming from specific streams
right.
that are generated through yeah. LURC, either valuation
None
or...
None of it's dedicated.
Right.
That you've had some sort of balance.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's the 800,000 or slightly over that's just plain out, flat out general fund appropriation.
Right.
Okay.
And then I think Samantha would respond to this question, too, at the bottom of page 2 in her hand. I believe these... Your table, Samantha, are these the fees and fines?
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Doran. That wasn't too harmful, was it? Too painful?
It was painless.
Still in the Novocaine for the dental chair.
The next piece, and if there is somebody from the County Commissioners here who wants to respond to it, that's great.
I think we have pause. Commissioner Paul Underwood is sitting up back there. Representative Underwood, you have anything to add, subtract, multiply to this process?
Not at this time. I'm not sure what he's referring to. NCCA?
Well, so the Maine County Commissioners Association asked for information on anticipated costs associated with the county opt-out and the impact on property taxes in the UT, which I think we had sort of summary of that. It was given to us by Mr. Doran.
No, that's...
And then you got the municipal cost component we're talking.
No, yeah. What he provided was this is the revenue that you could anticipate the counties would get. If they opted out, they would get these amounts,
right.
You know, for these three counties at least that he provided. The other piece... The people were asking questions of how much would it cost you if you opted out, and that's what I had sent a request via the County Commissioners Association to see if they had anything quantified. I went through all the testimony. I mean, there were a lot of people testifying with comments on what it would cost. The only and I had a spreadsheet that was provided to this committee back in the spring. From Piscataway's kind of just projected cost estimates where they itemized what would be needed, but I don't know whether anybody here has
brought
any more specific information.
County Commissioner Underwood's going to.
Specific to that question, I'm not sure who has done what as far as generating costs. Rushtik County's done an approximate calculation of what it would cost, what the revenues derived from the current stream of fees and taxes and fines and fees. We figured there was probably in Aroostook County about $100,000. We calculated roughly $250,000 for department, probably another $100,000 for initial startup. That's if we took on the full-blown responsibilities of a planning department, zoning boards of appeals, and whatnot. And I think perhaps I might speak to some of the conversations that have been going around and why there's no response to this is that commissioners around the state with UT counties are looking at the proposed changes generated by the Reform Committee. And I think most of these changes are endorsed by the commissioners, and there's really no impetus to go it alone. We recognize the cost and the issues because, as a former city councilor, I was on board when we redid our comprehensive plan. Commissioner Fournier from Allagrass is the chairman of his local planning board. He understands the commitment and the time necessary. But looking at it, realistically, there's a camaraderie, a brotherhood amongst the county commissioners that we really like to do things together. We have common problems, common solutions to our problems. We meet regularly to address these issues, especially where it comes to the UTs. Everything from picking up trash to issues with LERC. And we're looking at this now as there is local representation on the board with nominees. Now, there seems to be a hang-up on appointment, how it's going to go through, who gets approval. I don't see that as a problem, and most of the commissioners don't. That was a recommendation of the committee, and we don't have a problem with it. Other recommendations of the committee, a separation of permitting through forestry, DEP. We see that as a clarification of what LERC is supposed to do. LERC needs to become a true planning board. Right now, it's into everything, and it's getting nothing done. The biggest failure that I see for LERC in its 40 years is in Aroostook County. Aroostook County has the only solid waste water treatment facility in the entire UT. And it's located in Sinclair, a small village at the end of Long Lake. It came about as a result of the first LERC bill. There was a case of diphtheria, and that's one of the driving issues that kept that going. Now, there's a cluster of lakes right around there, and the camp lots look just like the chairs around this table. The lots were developed in the probably 1920s when the roads were opened up and opened up the lakes in that region. And the camp lots are small, and what we've had to do is develop leach fields for the camps because the camps are becoming more than just occasional summer usage. Some of them are coming three-season uses. So that's taking more land to develop these. We're taking more land from what was probably wooded lots, building them into grass areas, which increases the degradation. People are fertilizing it, the problems with developments around lakes. That should have been connected. That system should have been connected to at least three lakes and probably as many as 400 camps. And right now it still serves. We just extended it, the first extension to that district this summer in 40 years. That should have been started 40 years ago and continued on through. There's no planning for that. That's the job of a planning board, is to make sure these looking down the future and see what's going on. The LERC has become a reactive agency. So many rules and regulations. There's 300 pages to the comprehensive plan and I think 400 pages of rules. Now, one of the questions was asked about permitting. The only thing that County of Aroostook, I think, would do as far as permitting is permit by rule. If there's a permit by rule, why can't the counties issue it? It's cut and dry. If you want to put a shed on your lot, you get your setback requirements, follow those requirements. There's no need for somebody to drive to Ashland from Cross Lake. It's probably about an hour and a half drive. And that is where I see the counties under this new proposal doing. If there is to be some permitting by the county, only permit by rule. Those rules would be set by the board, the full board. And again, the talk around now is that this probably will work, and counties don't really have the impetus to move.
Okay, so I'm giving kind of a leeway here. two things. Financially, you really, in a sense, thought this was going okay. You really didn't want to deal with the finances, right? I mean, then you gave us three numbers here, though. You gave us the $100,000, $250,000, another $100,000. So what would you be doing? Who'd you be hiring? What would you be doing if you
were all that much money? Our public works director for the UT is currently a selectman for the town of Frenchville. And he has a lot of experience in this area. We probably have an additional staff member, maybe some subcontracting for inspections. I'm not sure. We haven't really gone down that road too far. As far as taxation, everybody's concerned about taxes. Okay, when you look at county taxes in the UT, we have the LD1, which limits the tax growth. The fiscal administrator for the UT, we heard from today, she also has input into the taxes. Legislative approval. You approve all the county budgets on the UT side. We have the residents who are concerned about taxes. We have landowners, and I say landowners mean large landowners. In Aroostook County, we have a finance committee that has final approval. And last of all, you have the commissioners, which really limit it as well, any tax growth. But those are all factors that will work towards minimizing the opt-out provision. If it works as a true planning board, there's no reason for us to split it up.
Okay, so we are talking about the financial side, I guess.
What finances would come to Aroostook? Is that what you're saying through this?
That's okay. Representative Tumeza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to help me understand a basic question here, I only need a one-sentence answer. When you build Caribou for county government, does that go in with the other as a revenue stream? Also, what you receive from unorganized gets put in, and that's part of the total budget? Is that where it goes?
No. The organized towns, with the exception of plantations, get a municipal cost component to the county tax. That goes to funding county government, your jails, your registry of deeds, probate, the regular things that county does, okay, sheriff's patrols.
That's going to...
The UT pays for its own municipal services that is provided. That's separate. There's two separate budgets, the UT side and the county side. And the UT does pay to the county a number which I think is 5% of its budget to the county tax.
Okay.
It's the largest municipal cost component in Aroostook County.
Okay, thank you. Before I go to the County Commissioner, Representative Kay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for being here, and also thank you for your information throughout the reform process.
Thank you for listening.
Oh, absolutely. You've been with us sort of since day one, and I appreciate that. You brought up the LD1 component, and I just sort of perked my interest. When you talk about the LD1 figure, are there some things that are exempted from the LD1, or does the entire budget need to be LD1 compliant?
To my immediate recollection, everything is subject to LD1 on both county budgets.
Okay.
UT as well as the regular county budget.
This is a recording of the Maine Legislature's Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry Committee meeting on February 28, 2012 to work on LD 1798, an act to reform land use planning in the unorganized territory.
Talked about if the three largest counties were to leave LURC and sort of, you know, how that...
I've heard the numbers.
Yeah, you know, it was just interesting because it wouldn't seem that for the counties that remain, they'd be able to be LD1 compliant with that type of an increase.
There are three revenue streams for LURC. You have the county component, property, which is property tax. Mm-hmm. Okay. Then you have a fee from, or a general fund appropriation, and then you have fines and fees.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The way I personally, and I'm not speaking for anybody other than myself, if this is a state board, it should all come out of fines, fees, and general appropriation. The property tax, where the property taxpayer has no input on this board, okay, shouldn't be paying for it. Okay? And if a county chooses to leave, it should leave its general appropriation behind, and it should be a decision of the counties that they are going to pay for this on their own. That's my personal feeling, and that's... I can't speak for other commissioners.
Representative McCain.
I would agree on that one piece of it, that if they leave, they don't take the money with them. But, you know, we're looking at some figures here that looks like more than half of the budget, if the top three left, LURC would actually lose that UT piece.
You do have to be clear, though. That's all going into the general fund. I mean,
but the general fund.
Yeah, and that part is getting smaller and smaller
right,
all the time.
It's not,
so
it's
yeah,
not
that
it's
absolutely.
None of this is dedicated revenue to LURC.
Sure.
Just, I mean, you can say that offsets what they get for general fund.
Sure. I just had deja vu. I thought we were talking about the dairy tier program for a moment there, Raphael, but I know that we're not. I'm just. Yeah.
Those are forbidden words in here, dairy tier. Okay, are we at the end of the line here, more ways than one?
I think you're through the questions, that information requests on the gray sheet. It's up to you how do you want to proceed, whether you want to go back to your green sheet or whether you want to look at the amendment that you reviewed, Representative Foster's amendment from last week, or if you want to go to the timber harvesting piece, which relates to LD 1739.
Probably the timber, if we have someone here, timber harvesting probably the best, because I don't think we're trying to gauge how long it would take us, and I think we've only been 2 hours, which seems a lot longer, but Representative Dale.
Yeah, I have a question. I've heard all these figures floating around here and opt-outs and the money that would go to the general fund. I guess my question is, and I don't know, Jill, who can answer this, but if a county were to opt-out, what kind of money is available to them through these systems that they would then therefore pay for them doing what LURC had been doing?
Well, I think those are the figures that Mr. Dorn gave you, at least for the three counties that I asked him to. Those counties would get that money the way that, according to Section 26.
Okay, so instead of going to the general fund,
right,
that would remain. So that would go
to the counties.
Then my question is, then I guess maybe for Samantha, if I may, Mr. Chair, would be, what does it cost LURC to do a project, a small project under 20 acres, depending on what it is, and I'm sure it must vary, from start to finish? What is the cost of LURC to go from planning, whatever they have to do, to finally give a permit for whatever it happens
There's
to be?
There's a hot seat again, Samantha.
It's very warm right now. I think I can give you an answer that may get us partway there, and then depending on what you need, I may be able to write more for another session. But so the budget is about $1.8 million. Almost all of that is personnel. We've got about $136,000 in all other. That runs six offices and all of our legal services and photocopiers and everything like that. We process in the very general range of about 1,000 permits a year, plus rulemaking and, you know, zoning, general planning, comprehensive plan, that sort of thing. And our planning services, we have five planners, one of whom is part-time, and a division manager, and that serves all 13 counties that are in the UT. So there's a lot of kind of shared services that spread across a number of permitting and planning activities. I'm not sure that I could give you a sense of, you know, how long it might take to process different kinds of permits and then ranges of salaries, but I'm not sure that would necessarily capture the equation that you're looking for.
Follow up, Representative Dale.
Just looking at your different permits, if I just look down, let's pick one in the middle, development permit. I want to put a commercial sporting camp up, just a couple camps. What would it cost, you know, the process, what would it cost LURC to get that through the process?
Of all the pick of the commercial sporting camp,
my
name is Rod Fowler. I'm the acting division manager for permitting and compliance. Of all projects to pick and choose as far as in the development permit, the commercial sporting camp is probably one of the most difficult to take and just assess, because there's many components to that. You've got not only the lodging, you've got the different constructions of the camps.
Okay.
It can be a retail store.
$200.
If there's no zoning involved, so in other words, if this is already zoned for a commercial operation and it's just a store and it's fairly straightforward, it's a permit that could probably be issued in about 3 weeks with the turnaround, so it would tie up staff time. I'm not sure how to put a value on that, though.
How much staff time?
That's a good question. I don't know how I would take it, you know, in a given period of time. There might be, because staff time, when they dedicate towards those kind of projects, there's an interaction with the agencies as far as the review comments. There's the actual drafting of the permit, and there's the interaction between the applicant and possible field time. You're probably going to deal with at least, two or three days, of work in a given time, full days, and then portions of days after that.
Would you like us to follow up with some more specifics?
I guess what I'm looking at is I took one of these. It doesn't matter what county. The top one on the list is Aroostook County. Just the way I'm hearing it, they opted out there to have $114,000 to do whatever LURIC does. And I guess I'm just questioning, is that two projects? Is that 25 projects before that money's eaten up? Or is it one project before that money's eaten up? And I realize it depends on, like you said, I picked sporting camps. That was the most difficult one. And I realize there's going to be a range. I could have picked bridge construction or anything. So I realize it's going to vary over lots of things. But what I'm just trying to get at is, you know, three or four different things. Maybe you could take sporting camps. You could take something simple. You could. I'm just trying to get an idea of what the cost would be.
I think one way to think about that would be, for instance, for Aroostook County, I mean, Billy and Don just serve Aroostook, right?
Correct.
So we have two full-time staff people. We have a planner who spends a portion of their time, plus then we have legal services, and we have planning time in terms of setting up the rules. And the, so, you know, if you kind of add all that up, I think that starts to get you close to some of the figures. If there's something specific we can provide to you for next time, I'd be happy to.
I know the figures that Piscataquis County had when they did the sheet, they actually came in, the three commissioners came into our office in Greenville to try to separate out Somerset County from Piscataquis. And they looked at the office, they looked at the number of permits we issued, they took a look and they went through everything as far as to recreate our office for Piscataquis County. I'm not sure exactly what they have on their sheet, but they were the one set of county commissioners that did come through and try to recreate our office for Piscataquis County.
Yep, thank you. Yes.
Just a brief question. Thank you, Senator. Sorry to make you walk away, and then I was going to ask Samantha a question.
Samantha.
So in regards to the legal component, is there typically, do you work with the same person in the Attorney General's office? Is it multiple people? I'm just not familiar with how that relationship works.
We have a primary contact. So there's an assistant attorney general who is the primary attorney that we work with. We don't have all of her time, but we have a significant portion of her time. In addition, on specific matters, she may consult other AAGs in their areas of specialty. And the section chief has done the legal work around Plum Creek, so there's been a significant number of hours put in by the section chief, especially regarding the litigation, but also during the development of the permit. So primary point of contact, but then we rely on some of the other resources as well. Does that answer your question?
No, I'm just curious. You know, I think of my time on the planning board, and, you know, every once in a while there would be the need for sort of an opinion. And I know in with the selectmen in Skowhegan, they frequently do it, but the type of projects that I see LURIC working on, I imagine each of the projects several times during the development phase of the actual project or just the permitting phase, it would seem like there would have to be sort of legal review and correspondence. So,
yeah, the larger projects, we have a lot of legal review of because of the extensive nature of the decision documents that we've been writing, and we want to make sure that those hold up well in court, and also she advises us on the issues surrounding making sure we're following the appropriate public process, again, to make sure that everything holds up in court and that we're following the law. The more routine cases, you know, typically don't involve legal review until there's an issue where if there's a violation that is not easily resolved and starts to become more serious or difficult to resolve, we'll check in with her to make sure we're following the appropriate processes. She also advises us on the Attorney General's office has to sign off on our rulemaking to make sure it's compliant with the statute. So those are the sorts of things that.
Sure.
And she attends each of the commission meetings. She
okay, so they are at the commission meetings. Yeah. And the other piece to that is.
Follow-up?
Sorry, Mr. Chair, just a brief follow-up or a clarification
brief
point.
Clarification.
So in regards to the Plum Creek project, the appeal that's being heard right now isn't on the actual project, but rather the process, is that?
That's right.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Samantha? No other questions? So I guess we have two things left to do. We have E, the timber harvesting piece, and that's a language check, the LD 1739. And then at some point, we've got to decide what we're going to do next Thursday. I think next Thursday, we also have a so-called fertilizer bill. Representative Cray is not here. We've got, and when he gets back here, I think but that's going to be on tap for Thursday also, right? So we'll finish up the timber harvesting and then sort of see what we can do, set a schedule for Thursday, along with the fertilizer bill, so-called.
Okay. The blue language Megan's going to pass out right now, and I think there should be plenty of extras for people. And you voted this bill. This is an act to change regulations of forestry activities. And this was a separate bill that came in as a department bill and asked to have Maine Forest Service oversee regulation and to do the regulation and the enforcement for timber harvesting activities. There's several pieces to it. Most of them you've seen before. Again, this is a bill you voted. The shaded sections are language that you haven't seen. At the last work session, there were concerns that about the FEMA being consistent the Bureau of Forestry takes over the this piece that people don't lose their flood insurance from FEMA to make sure that stays consistent. There was also questions about how NERPA would work into this right now. DEP has LURC has delegation from DEP to do NERPA permits, and there was one. It was like how would this happen if timber harvesting and other activities are going to the Maine Forest Service, how would the NERPA permits be handled? What you have is, I've worked with Don Manzius and Doug Denico from the Bureau of Forestry on this, and Samantha Horn Olson on this. I'm not sure the language is quite right yet, but I think it's closer. And if you wanted to just walk through this blue, I think I could point out what's you've seen before and what you haven't seen before. Does that seem like an approach? And if you have questions in terms of what some intent may be, then you may want to bring others up here. The first section is as you have seen it before. This is for
excuse me, so we're on page 3?
No, you're on page 1, actually.
Oh.
Of the blue. No.
Okay.
No,
just the underline there. I'm sorry.
Section 1 you've seen before. Section 2, I tried to do this in shading, but then it didn't show up with the blue. This was discussed at your last work session, but you didn't have the language. I mean, at the last work session, you had language that would have roads, timber harvesting activities, which includes roads for forest management, were going to the Bureau of Forestry. But also they want to do, and there's agreement between LURC and Maine Forest Service, I understand, to allow the Forest Service to do the permitting and the administration for all land management roads. And land management roads, this would be roads used for agricultural management activities and forest management activities, and also for gravel pits of under 5 acres and for water crossings. So this language looks.
Question? Ripson McGabe. Okay, so you wanna wait a minute?
The only thing, if and I, it's fine to ask questions, however you want to do it,
Representative McCabe's a little ahead of the game here.
Okay. Well, you'll notice the language that's in that blue. This is subsection 4 near the end of the page. That second paragraph says, the rules must require a permit from the Bureau for activities located within areas of special flood hazard as defined in the Commission's rules. LURC has all the floodplain mapping and stuff, and that's the sentence that's put in that hopefully will make sure that shift is consistent and FEMA is okay and still recognizes that compliance. And then the second sentence, this came up, there was concern LURC had brought up in regard to the timber harvesting, that there are certain, if the Bureau of Forestry is going to assume these responsibilities in protection districts and management districts. And in the protection districts, there are some sub-districts where there are other things to look at that they brought up, the historic, scenic, scientific, recreational, and aesthetic. And so this language is just to make sure that those don't get lost when they go over to the Bureau of Forestry. The second page, this at the top, this is all the language. This is the chop and drop language. The only new sentence there is, and I'm not sure this sentence is necessary. I might want to revise it a little bit, but concerns were brought up that under the chop and drop, people, to make sure that you still have to stay within the allowable cut under shoreland zoning and under the forestry's rules for timber harvesting in shoreland areas. So that bold italics captures the intent of that. I'm not sure it's necessary, but that's why that's there. That's the only new language in that section. And then again, section 5 is a companion piece. On page 1, we were over in LURC statutes, and now we're still in Title 12, but we're in the chapter for the forestry chapter. This is section 5, a new subsection. This is directing the Bureau of Forestry to administer and enforce. And then it's the Commissioner of Conservation is the one in their statutes that typically it has rulemaking authority. And again, there's language about the rules must require a permit if it's within a special flood hazard, an area of special flood hazard. I don't know whether either Samantha Horn Olson or Mr. Denico would like to talk about this language, or if the committee has any questions on that.
Representative McCabe got a question about water crossings. I see water crossings in here. Representative McCabe, is that the one you had a question on, bottom page 2?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have questions on 2 of the sections, but just in the interest of staying in order, I'm happy to start with that one. I guess for me, I'm trying to grasp the water crossing piece, and it might be helpful if Mr. Denico came up, and then I could ask him.
Come on, Mr. Denico.
Doug Denico, Maine Forest Service.
Sure. So under the water crossing piece, I think that, are we talking all water crossings? You know, I'm thinking of, I'll give you a real-life scenario. You leave the Marshall Yard, and you go out over that bridge. That's actually a box culvert, I believe, or arch culvert now.
Arch culvert, yeah.
Yeah. Are we talking that type of water crossing, or are we talking something that's more of a temporary crossing?
No, we're talking the permanent crossings. What we've done in here, and it's made this thing longer, but we needed to make it longer. Satisfying folks is that there's some special areas that LURC is concerned about that they want to keep additional control. And one of the crossings is the special river segments, and you'll pick up on that in different sections. That's one thing that we've carved out, that if we can go ahead and do a permit, but we have to do it with concurrence of the Land Use Regulation Commission. And we're not sure we still have quite the, I think LURC and Maine Forest Service are on the same page where we want what we want to do, but we're still having trouble with the language art.
Sure.
But it's about concurrence. We want to we'll do the permitting, but they need to be able to say okay when we're done. And it's for certain places. And one is special river segments, but not generally. No, they're fine letting us do the general crossings. Just a few places that they'd like to have that concurrence.
Okay.
And then there's some areas where they want to have more control over roads, particularly along trail segments in some of the RR districts.
Sure. I think there's an area where we've had feedback in the last few years from landowners. Some of us had the opportunity to go up north a couple of years ago and look at some of the roads and actual stream crossings, and one of the issues there seemed to be time as far as being able to get a permit. But I also think of some of these larger ones, and I was just thinking of capacity of the Forest Service and making sure that you folks had sort of the capacity and, we weren't burdening you with sort of added engineering and pieces of that to, review some of these. So
we don't look at that as a burden, no.
Okay.
As an honor, you're looking at that.
We'll talk costs later, I guess, as we get into some other areas.
I don't think this. I think Commissioner Beardsley is the one to address that, but as far as I know, there's very little cost associated with what we are going to be doing.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Janico.
Representative Cabes, I get both your issues.
Oh, no.
Okay. Jill, moving on, I guess.
Okay. So again, that language is that the responsibility is going to the Maine Forest Service, but LORC will be involved, particularly for areas that have been designated as having some kind of unique resources needing special protection. Section 6, this is on page 3, the fee schedule. Maine Forest Service hasn't they don't have permits and charge fees under this section of their law, but if they're going to start doing permits for what's required, a LORC permit is required now, and they pay a fee to LORC for that activity. If Maine Forest Service starts to do those activities, then this would give them it allows them to establish a schedule of fees through rulemaking. The way I've written it, specific to those new responsibilities. They can't use this authority to go out and charge a whole bunch of other fees. So I've written fairly specifically. And you'll just note that usually these, anytime fees are being authorized, and usually there needs to be either a range or a maximum in statute, or it becomes a major substantive rule. That's why the notwithstanding language. If you're comfortable with them doing these, doing the fees, then that's fine to have them come in as routine technical, but it does have that.
Senator Schneider.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jill, did you check out the question I had last time about rulemaking and about how the rules, because that bill that we just passed.
Oh.
Did you check into that?
I'm sorry.
Well, could you just do that for next time? Because this is all, because it could be to completely not an issue, and yet sometimes we struggle over it.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. I just.
One list by
any. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Moving on.
So that's new language. There was some changes just in terms on page 5, just in terms of the effective date. This is where the municipalities, this is the timber harvesting and shoreland areas and riparian areas, and there's just some language change on the top of page 5 saying they're putting in a date whereby municipalities that have already accepted the state standards or have adopted an ordinance that's identical, standards would apply January 1st, 2013. This has to do with not waiting until you get the certain number of municipalities. If they've already agreed and want to abide by those standards, that go into effect January 2013.
Any questions? Seeing none, Jill, move on.
And then I think at the bottom of page 5, and this is some language similar to some language that you saw in the amendment that Commissioner Aho brought to you today. This is This is over in NERPA, the delegation of permit granting authority to conservation for the timber harvesting activities.
Any questions? Seeing none, move on.
And then there's just the transition language has changed a bit, just to make sure that the department and commission shall review, this is unallocated language, shall review standards in effect to protect historic, scenic, scientific, recreational, and aesthetic resources in areas identified by work as requiring special protection. And it's just basically a directive for the department and LURC to work together as this transfer takes place to make sure those areas are protected.
Doug?
There's two sections in here that we agree in principle we still need some wordsmithing, and this is one of them, section 13. We've worked some language out partly today, but we've been kind of rushed on it. And the other section is section 14. We'd like to be able to come back with a few, some language changes in those two. Those are the only ones that we think we have some things we'd like to still clear up a little bit better. And again, to give alert the comfort they need in certain areas, so as we take things over, they have the authority to still need to retain.
We have a little trouble with section 14. We don't seem to have it.
It's section 2, I think he's referring to. It's
section
some two, section 14.
Section 14, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And the other section 3 is under section 12.
Okay, thank you.
So we're going to have another
thing. Yes. Yep.
You have, this is one you have voted, but you do need, we'll continue to work. Yeah?
Tweaking time.
But does anyone have questions about the substantive differences? Is it just?
Representative McCabe, you must have.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question was in regards to the section 12. It would be 32 there, page 6 and 7, and it's in regards to the chop and drop. I just like to use that term. I think our discussion last time around sort of was we kept circling around the issue of involving the biologists, whether it was DMR, IF&W, and I didn't see that here specifically, and I just want to make sure that we somehow involve them. I know they spent most of the day sitting in the front row, and we didn't really call on them, but our committee discussion was sort of around a way to involve them. I think we felt, or the general consensus was, that a permit wasn't needed, but that there needed to be some sort of sign-off or sponsorship from a biologist, from DMR or IF&W, and one of the, yeah. So
that language is on page 2, the second paragraph from the top. That's over where forestry is being in the forestry statutes, but the section you're referencing, maybe it does need to be there too. That's where it's being, all that's happening in section 12 is under NERPA, you're saying a permit is not required for the activities. If the chop and drop is done in accordance with 8867C and rules to implement it, and the language in 8867C is on page 2, the second paragraph from the top, is that enough for what you're looking for, or would you like more detail?
I think my recollection was that when we discussed it, there was an interest to have some sort of, you know, oversight by a biologist and.
Oh, actually, when it's being done, you mean?
Or with that specific, you know, example or stream that it, you know, was deemed appropriate. And I think it was. Okay. I think the Forest Service and Mr. Denico can probably talk to this. That they seemed interested in that component.
Yeah,
so.
We had a 9-point program that we gave you folks, and what would happen is no area has anything done to it unless the fisheries biologists say,
sure,
this is the area that this chop and drop will take place.
Mm-hmm.
The fisheries biologists are the only ones that can designate that. And then,
sure.
the Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife, and it's not in there, but we could put it in there, the DMR, help us develop the rules on what takes place there.
Sure.
And we could add that in there very simply. And then the other piece is that when we proceed to do those activities, they notify IFNW that they're now there. And also the training. There's going to have to be some training take place for the licensed foresters before they can do this. And the training would also be put together by IFNW as well as the Maine Forest Service and DMR if they wanted.
Sure.
So there's about four levels there where those agencies have a lot to say on what it looks like, what we do. But the beginning is we can't do anything unless IFNW fisheries people say, that's the place. So there's, I think, a lot of oversight going on there.
So do you think we could achieve it in like a one line, two line?
I'd be happy to put that in there if you want it, that specificity in the rules.
Sure. I would appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to bring that back.
Yeah, try that and we'll see it on Thursday. We'll have to mark that as the McCabe Amendment and never to be touched again.
Mr. Chair, I was going to name it for Representative Edgecombe, who really seemed concerned about trout habitat.
Yeah. By the way, I showed some of those photographs to some senators, and they said, you're going to do what with chop and tar? Drop. They didn't like the looks of it, so they might vote against us just on that basis. I think we're getting to the end here, I'm sure. McCabe,
we actually have a native brook trout habitat in Skowhegan, and that's the biggest complaint of the adjacent landowners is the fact that there's woody debris in the stream, and it's actually at the end of the Russell Road behind the old Solon Manufacturing Storage Building. So I imagine you've driven by it, and that's an eyesore people feel. So absolutely, absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Denico.
Okay, Jill, are we at the end of this mess here after 3 hours?
You've gone through a lot. I do you want to look at Representative Foster's amendment, the language that's come back on that?
I see everyone looking down as I look left and right. I hear too much information overload already.
Well, then if you just
we've been at this, that would be an item for Thursday, maybe. Take a look at the language.
Okay, do you want to kind of... Oh, you didn't. Copy's great. So then you go down. Yeah. I don't know if I read it. Thanks so much. If you want to just identify, go through again what you need, what you would like for Thursday, or I can send you a list tomorrow. That how would you like? What approach
Let's do both, because we can do it around the table. I think I'm concerned first of all with the bill around the $1 fee that we've got to do Thursday. It has nothing to do with this.
Oh yeah.
And so I don't know if Representative Cray wants to talk about the bill that we can do in a hurry. Shaking his head no. Because that has to be done, right? We should have that done as soon as we can.
I think Representative Dill and I are all set on that. Thank
you. That makes me feel a lot better, I'm sure.
So if that one's going to go quickly, that'll be first on your agenda on Thursday, would be
I think it should be, yes.
Okay.
Well, you've got to follow protocol anyway. Yeah. So, Jill, why don't you put what you think we need to hear on, if that's possible. You've heard some comments here.
Well, I think I know that you want to before you talk about rulemaking anymore, Senator Schneider has asked for clarification on the bill that just passed and what impact that would have from a practically speaking on any rules that are adopted under this legislation. I think you want, Commissioner Aho, you want to have an opportunity to look a little more at the language that she provided, what the practical impacts of that are going to be.
Yeah.
and then...
Well, the Foster Amendment.
Read the Foster Amendment, yeah. And then I guess go back to the sheets on the items on the green sheet that you were waiting
the bucket.
On.
So we can do it in the bucket. I think purpose and scope is on there. What else is on that?
Well, the small projects, you talked about that today, about moving small projects to the counties, whether the language in the bill is sufficient. That's the section, I believe section 19 of the bill where it proposes you, that's another weight. Then the site law we talked about with the commissioner today and... just more. Did you get enough information today on how a project would be treated differently under site law versus LURC versus, do you need anything more on that?
It might be wise to have something in writing so we can.
Okay. So do you want like an example of a subdivision taking place in LURC jurisdiction that
as long as it's smaller than Plum Creek, that's
okay. So the. Yeah. So that would be helpful if you had a subdivision taking place within LURC jurisdiction that would trigger site law review, how that would differ, and to have them walk you through exactly what LURC would be doing in terms of public process.
Something along those lines, yeah. I think Senator Schneider said.
That would be very helpful.
Yeah.
I've got to ask. I mean, the expertise exists here today. To explain that, doesn't it?
I don't know.
I mean, I don't know about you, but I like to read what I've been given so far, and it's really hard for me to sit here and go through an entire new amendment. And unless you would like to sit here and explain that to me thoroughly, I'd like time. I'd like time.
It's 20 minutes to four.
I don't know
what fight
more
here
about that.
In a minute.
Senator, okay, so that's
Senator Snyder, I'm with you. I like to see things because, frankly, we may have to take this guy on between us here, actually.
Okay, so you'll do a walkthrough of one example.
Right.
How site law, how that change would look. The other thing I'll have you a time, effective date for the legislation. I mean, there's different effective dates in the bill the way it's written. There's other dates that have been proposed or tossed around. So I think you'll want to nail those as you go through on Thursday. And I can show you where the different dates are, and you can decide what you want to be effective.
Yeah.
In terms of... I have on the gray sheet, there's some suggested language. It was suggested that there be a directive to facilitate a pre-application discussion. I drafted some up. You can look at that and see if that's something you want to include, if that's enough detail, or if you want more detail. Again, it's unallocated language. And unallocated language for prospective zoning. People seem to say at the last work session if they wanted to give a strong direction to the new Land Use Planning Commission to start this, and you may want to look at that and think of if you want to include specific dates. You may also want to think of some of the testimony you heard people were wanting to say. How soon do you want to see either changes in the CLOP or changes or LURC's amending rules to be consistent with the changes in the purpose. This gets to the purpose and scope section that you haven't discussed, but you may want to put in some directives in terms of how quickly you expect that to happen.
So we can do us all this Thursday. The red line, I forgot where I went to, the amendment had the red in red.
DEP
the DEP amendments. Yes. We probably need to take a look at that. At least I've read it before Thursday. So, Representative Dill, anything you want to see Thursday? Representative Black? Representative Dill?
I'm all set.
All set again, twice.
I'm all set.
This is that fertilizer thing again. Representative Inchcombe? All set. Thibodeau? Snyder?
I'm good. I'm just going to look at that.
Okay. Foster? All set, Jeff. So we'll call this meeting to an end. Thank you for your patience. Move to adjourn. Thank you.